another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, and I'm here with you. I'm a naturopathic physician and herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild, and usually here with Dr. Kamai, the natural nurse. She has the day off, and I'm in control here. So we're going to be talking about health, wellness, and alternative medicine. And you can always get more information about what we're doing at our respective websites, which is naturalnurse.com or drznaturally.com. And so today's guest is a really interesting one, and we have Dr. Robert Brody here. And from a young age, Dr. Brody has found an interest in natural medicine and the power of nature. He was influenced by his dad, who's a practicing nutritionist in Pennsylvania, and he became an Eagle Scout and is a third-degree black belt in Aikido, and also works with me at the University of Bridgeport, where he sees patients, too, and as well as his own practice. And he certainly is an outdoorsman and likes to kayak and hike and mountain bike, but one thing that Dr. Brody is a real expertise in is that he has his naturopathic degree, and he also completed his residency at the Center of Excellence in Generative Medicine under the illustrious Dr. Peter Diadamo, the world-renowned author of Eat Right for Your Type and one of the creators of the blood type diet. And Dr. Brody is currently working at the Center of Excellence, and then also sees patients at the College of Naturopathic Medicine, and then also his private practice in Newtown, Connecticut. And so we're going to be talking about like things like blood type diet, genotype diet, and making sense out of this. So welcome, Dr. Brody. It's great to have you on.
Hey, Dr. Z. Thank you very much for having me back on.
Yes. So, of course, Dr. Brody was one of my students, too, and then is, of course, taken off on his own path, which is wonderful to keep naturopathic medicine alive and keep the spirit of nature, keep nature in naturopathy is what we say. So one of the things that we share in common is I also was Dr. Diadamo's, one of his first residents, and did a lot of the groundbreaking and backbreaking, by the way, because back then there was no internet, and I had to bring a pocket full of nickels to make photocopies of all types of literature pertaining to the blood type diet. I remember giving Dr. Diadamo those books on lectins and articles and devouring them, both of us, and getting really excited about this. And then years later, he came out with his groundbreaking book, Eat Right for Your Type. So we're going to talk about that. So let's talk a little bit about you yourself, Dr. Brody, a little bit, and what got you interested in actually taking this path of naturopathic medicine, studying blood type and genotype.
It's a great story. I actually wasn't interested in it at all in the very beginning of my first days of naturopathic medical school. It was only after I realized that that nothing was working for a medical condition that I had. And I finally ended up changing my diet around a little bit, and I made a connection that, hey, if I follow this simple blood type diet thing, my cystic acne goes away. I'm like, oh, this is great. So I stopped eating the dairy, and I stopped eating a lot of the breads and stuff along those lines. My acne cleared up. And then I decided, oh, that's all, I'm all cured. Let me go back on eating my regular standard diet. And it came back. And I was going back and forth. And I kind of finally sunk in that, hey, this diet has something to it. It actually is helping me, my medical condition.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Certainly when we prove it to ourselves, and certainly a lot of our patients have to kind of walk it and try it out in order for them to see benefits. But let's go back to the whole idea of blood type. Now, when I did the work with Dr. Diadamo, you know, blood type was part of the theory, but it also involved these things called lectins and a lot that had to do with the gut. Can you connect these things? Because, you know, I look at some literature in the, and, you know, on the internet, and people still don't understand what in the world your blood type is in the first place, and second of all, what it has to do with what you eat.
It's a very good question. Yeah, most people think we have blood type, you know, to mess up pregnancies or to mess up transfusions when you're getting surgery. But that's not why we were designed to have blood type. And all blood type is a little sugar that's on the outside of your cells. And all that sugar does is separates you from what's not you. So if something comes inside your body's got to then determine if it's a good guy or a bad guy. If it's a good guy, your body's going to break it down, and it's going to utilize it as energy and vitamins and minerals and all that fun stuff. But if it recognizes it as a bad guy, it's going to go through a process of inflammation to get rid of it.
So but it's interesting that I think people don't make the connection, Dr. Brody, that really your blood type is really a marker on all your cells. They don't realize that your blood is that type is actually a cell type. And this cell type is, in most people, if you're a secretor, as they say, maybe we can talk about that, is sort of broadcast on every cell in your body. So really, Dr. Diadamo should have named the book The Cell Type Diet, but I guess that wasn't as sexy name as Eat Right for Your Blood Type. And it does have a lot to do with the blood type anyway. And blood is pretty accessible as far as cells go. All you got to do is stick a needle in your arm, and out comes the cells. Tell us a little bit about get down to the cellular level and tell us what's going on the cells in more detail.
Yeah, there's a couple things. I mean, well, I think the first thing I'd like to address is that Dr. Diadamo, when he wrote the book Eat Right for Your Type, he was writing that book for the general public. So most people don't really know the science behind it. And, you know, I would say that Dr. Diadamo is really an expert in something called glycobiology, which is the study of sugars on the outside of your cells. And that's literally what you were just saying, Dr. Z, that this blood type, the sugar that's on the outside of your cells is all over the place. You can kind of think of the sugar on the outside of your cell or like a lectin, which is it's a protein that binds the sugars, as kind of like Velcro and kind of one of those balls that you throw back and forth, the balls that you catch on the little plates when you're down at the beach or whatever. So, and I always like to take the example of taking a cardboard box and putting a whole bunch of tennis balls in this cardboard box and cutting up a whole bunch of Velcro and putting it in that box and shaking it up. As you're shaking that box up, eventually all those cells are going to stick together to that Velcro. You're going to have one giant clump in that box. Compared to taking a whole bunch of baseballs, the little red stitching on it, and throwing that box with the same amount of Velcro and shaking it up, that Velcro is not really going to be sticking all those balls together. And in this example, the Velcro is actually acting as a lectin that's binding to different cells. So one of the classic examples of this reaction is how we first discovered blood type in the first place. One of the scientists back in the turn of the 19th century realized that if you take some lima beans and you throw it on different blood types, different blood, sometimes it'll cause the agglutination process or these Velcro balls sticking together. And this is one of the ways that your body determines what's good and what's not good. It depends on that sugar.
Right, and so that, you know, that saved a lot of people's lives because of we didn't realize why when people got different blood, they would basically die. What would happen to the blood? It'd get all clumpy, right? Just like the tennis ball analogy you're using.
Mm-hmm. It would get all clumpy, and your body doesn't like things that aren't normal, that are not natural to itself. So it sees this giant clump of tennis balls or these giant clumps of cells in your body, and it's going to say, hey, that's not good. Let me go get rid of that. And in the surgery situation, if you're blood type A and you've got blood type B blood inside of you, your body's going to cause a major reaction, and you can possibly die from that. That's why it's so important to have this blood type and know your blood type.
So now when we eat the wrong type of food for our constitutional, let's call it cell type, you know, for people out there, just so we can throw that around there. So when you're eating the wrong type of food for your cell type, explain what happens, what some of the physiological things that can go awry. I mean, you developed acne, but there's a whole plethora of other things that can happen to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's very common. You know, every food that we eat is going to be made up of many different chemicals, many different nutrients, vitamins, all these things. one of the classic examples that we're talking about, and Dr. D'Adamo has written extensively on, is lectins. So when we're consuming foods that have the wrong type of lectin, it causes the agglutination process. And this agglutination process, there's inflammation that can happen in your body, can affect everything from the achiness in your joints. You can have like arthritic symptoms. You can have maybe messed up thyroid. You have thyroid issues. You can have increased risk of different developmental cancers and developmental delays. You have many different reactions that can happen within the body by eating foods that you're not supposed to eat. A perfect example of this is wheat, and that's one of the hot topics that are out there right now. Everyone's going gluten-free, gluten-free, gluten-free. And I'm actually one of the doctors who don't necessarily believe in gluten-free diets unless you have something called celiac disease. I believe more that people who are sensitive to gluten are actually sensitive to the lectin in the wheat, and that's what's causing their reactions, their digestive disorders and their headaches and migraines and hormone problems. Is actually the lectin. So a lot of times these people, when they come in to see me, if they've been gluten-free and they want to try to increase their diet a little bit or try to open up their palate when they're out of a restaurant or they're cooking for their family members, a lot of times they can actually introduce or reintroduce some of the other types of wheat that would be okay for them, maybe like a sprouted wheat or maybe like rye bread or kamut types of grains.
Why do plants have these lectins in them? There's got to be some sort of Gaia reason for having lectins. It must serve some purpose for the plant.
Yeah, I love when people ask me this question because most people, never even stop and think, why do we have these things in the first place? And the reason why that plants have these lectins on them or these chemicals on their leaves and their seeds and stuff along those lines is to protect itself. So if a little caterpillar comes around and is eating the leaf of the maple tree, the maple tree doesn't want to die, so it's got to secrete something to protect itself. So it secretes maybe these lectins in the leaves, and it'll tell the caterpillar, hey, don't eat these leaves because it's going to upset your stomach. Go to that tree over there and eat those leaves. The same thing with blood type. Most people don't stop and think why we have blood type. It's a very profound thing when you think that nature is a smart, intelligent thing, and it does things to protect itself.
So it's all about these lectins that Well, I think also what was interesting about Dr. D's work is that he also looked at the anthropology of the blood type, kind of how they evolved historically over time and how blood types changed, actually. And even disease processes can actually, there's been instances I remember finding in the literature where people actually, with strange blood cancers, actually changed their blood type. Talk about how the blood types evolve throughout humanity.
Yeah, it's actually a very interesting topic. This has recently changed, but for sake of argument, you can always say that blood type O is the oldest blood type out there, kind of the first blood type out there. And generally, we see a lot of the blood type O population, kind of the native people. So maybe like Inuits up in Alaska, or the Aborigines down in Australia, or different tribes in Africa and South America, are generally a little bit more of a blood type O nature. And it kind of goes back to a little bit of that kind of hunter-gatherer lifestyle, and that's generally where blood type O's fall.
So O actually means zero, right, Dr. Brody? O is actually a zero. Is that true?
That is correct. They don't have an A antigen or a B antigen, so it doesn't have an A sugar, make you a blood type A, or a B sugar on that. So it should be called zero antigen if you're over in Europe, correct?
Okay. So then what came next after the O's, you think?
Arguably was blood type A's when kind of humans started settling down and cultivating lands a little bit. They started farming. They started raising animals. And generally think of farmers, and they don't necessarily want to kill the cow or the chicken because they want those eggs from that chicken to sustain themselves throughout the season. So they usually do a little bit better time with more of a vegetarian diet or more like a Mediterranean diet with kind of not as much animal protein.
And there's two types of A's, as I recall from my work with Dr. D.
Yeah, there's actually two subtypes. There's blood type A1 and blood type A2. And it goes back into the study of sugars because there's about 295 different blood types out there. And most of us, we only think of the ABO blood types, so I'm blood type O or I'm blood type B. or am the positive and negative factor of the rhesus blood type. So I'm O positive or B negative. But there's many, many different types of blood type out there. And generally, blood type A1s, we have a little bit more of an issue with A1s for the development of cancers compared to blood type A2s, which have a little bit more of an increased risk of heart diseases.
Yeah, I find that A2s, they tend to be more European of descent, northern descent, you know, and they do a little bit better with protein and fish and things like that, whereas the A2s are more from, like, I don't know, southern Europe, northern Africa, that kind of area there, and they seem to do well with other types of foods. And so it's very specific as to what you would then tell someone to eat if they came to your office and then you actually check their blood type. So many people don't even know their blood type. It's kind of fascinating. I ask, that's like one of the first questions on my questionnaire that I send out to patients. What's your blood type? And they're like, I don't know. No one ever told me. So then it's easy for people to find out their blood type, correct?
Yeah, you can go to any doctor and they can either run the test for you or they can look up their records. Or you can go anywhere where you can donate blood and go to, you know, American Red Cross, and you can donate blood and just ask them for your blood type, and you'll have an idea what it is, and you can kind of go off of it from there. Some of the more advanced stuff, like we were talking about earlier, like secretor status and your subtype of blood type A, if you're A1 or A2, that's a little bit more difficult to order. You usually have to go through Quest Labs or LabCorp, you know, talk to a doctor to order that.
I see, yeah. So then you can get down to the nitty-gritty. So then the Bs came along. Was that the next in line?
That would be the next in line, would be the blood type Bs. And generally, the way that I like to remember blood type Bs, these are the population that are originally from the highest elevations in Earth and the lowest elevations of Earth. So if we take a picture of the map of kind of Asia in our head, or Europe and Asia in our head, we kind of see the blood type Bs originally starting kind of in the eastern part of Europe, going down through the Middle East with the lowest part, you know, in the world, the Dead Sea over there, going across the continent kind of through India and Pakistan with the highest elevations over there, and then kind of up the coast of China and Japan and Korea. That was kind of the original belt of blood type Bs that are out there.
Hmm. And then, of course, AB came, and they're kind of considered, I guess, a more anomaly in a way.
Yeah, they really came about as a mixture of blood type A's and B's coming together and having offsprings of being AB. So it's a relatively new blood type, and it's a very low population. It's something around 1% or so of the population is blood type AB.
So AB negative would be extremely rare then?
AB negative would be extremely rare, yes. It's a very rare blood type. They generally want you donating blood if you are AB negative.
Now, the other thing that Dr. Diadamo was into is his father's original research, James Diadamo, and he wrote the classic book, One Man's Food is Another Man's Poison. And I think that, as far as I recall talking to Dr. D, he was actually trying to see if his father's, because I read, it's so funny, how I met Dr. Diadamo is I was actually going through some papers at Bastyr University when I was out in Washington getting my degree in naturopathic medicine, and I found Dr. Diadamo's senior research paper where he was trying to look at his father's research or his father's concepts, which he learned from, you know, some of the European blood type masters, to see if it even held weight, to see if it held water, you know, as a theory. And that's kind of how I then got interested in, and then I found out Dr. D was practicing out in Connecticut, and I needed to preceptor with someone. You know, in naturopathic training, you have to actually spend many hours with practicing naturopathic physicians to get trained. And that's kind of how I met up with him. He was gracious enough to host me as preceptor for a while, and then postdoc for a couple of years doing research on him. And I actually did a research project and wrote a paper in the now defunct Journal of Naturopathic Medicine, where we were looking at why blood type O's have such a vigorous immune response against the outside world. Why are there more autoimmune disease in the blood type O community? And I actually found out that most things in nature have a blood type. Tell us about that crazy concept. I'm talking about molds and dusts and allergens, things that we don't even think have a blood type. And it's actually that they have some type of a pattern on their body that our body recognizes.
Yeah, I mean, you think of blood type, once again, as a sugar that's on the outside of your cells. It's a sugar that's going to interact with your cells and your immune system. So when you eat certain things or different viruses or bacteria, they're all going to have little sugars on the outside of the cells. And one of the most common and preferable types of sugars are the ABO blood types. We can actually trace back through history. We can say, hey, we dig up some bones and like, hey, this person died of bubonic plague. And, oh, look, they're blood type O. Or, hey, we have a bad cholera outbreak in Haiti. And if you're blood type O, you have increased risk of that. Or if you have your blood type A, you might have an increased risk of streptococcus infections or strep infections. Or we can keep going back through antiquity to figure out these different viruses and bacteria actually bind to your cells and cause your immune system to get activated and cause a lot of inflammation in the process. And it's kind of one of those interesting things. You know, we had the flu virus that came out earlier this year. And I believe, please correct me if I'm wrong, it was H2N3 virus this year.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all that means, the H1 or the H3N2, all that means is different blood types, different sugars on the outside of the cells. And they kind of change from year to year, that virus. But generally speaking, this was a very bad flu season because those sugars on that virus out there like to bind to blood type Bs and ABs, which it usually does, but also blood type As out there. So now all of a sudden we have about 60% of the population affected by the kind of the flu virus compared to normally about 20% or so.
So basically you're saying that bacteria and fungi and parasites and other microorganisms, in order to infect someone, they have to somehow get into the body and somehow latch on to a cell to start their machinery going on, right, to start their replication. And the way that they latch on to the cell is with blood type?
It can be with blood type, yep, and all the different sugars out there.
So that makes a lot of sense. So that means that if we could design things to sort of stop them from attaching, then we can really help out with infectious disease.
That is correct. I mean, one of the perfect examples, there's a couple of them that are already designed for us. We were just talking about the flu virus, and you know, Sambucus or elderberry actually works at stopping the transfer or binding to those cells, make sure that the virus doesn't spread from cell to cell. The other thing is we can actually take supplements and stuff along those lines that have free blood type in them. And one of the most common ones out there that everyone is taking is usually for knees and joints and stuff along those lines for blood type A's. And that's called glucosamine chondroitin, or glucosamine. Now, once a blood type A takes this glucosamine inside of them, it gets broken down to the stomach, and now you get free blood type A sugars inside your body. And there's different bacteria. And I used to be a professional or amateur professional whitewater kayaker, and I had this before, but there's a certain bacteria or parasite called Giardia that likes to bind to blood type A's. But if I take a whole bunch of glucosamine and I'm a blood type A, that bacteria is going to bind to that supplement and go up through my digestive tract and not bind to my cells and set up shop.
So it's kind of like that Velcro thing. It's like a piece of, like, so figure the bacteria has this Velcro on it, and if you gum it all up with lint, so now the Velcro can't stick. It just gets flushed away, and if you can't stick, you can infect. That's the concept, pretty much.
Correct. We don't want any cells or bacteria to set up shop and make a home and get food and invite friends over. We want those guests to go directly out of the body.
So this creates a whole new realm in medicine that you guys studying this is doing, because, you know, we're just basically focusing on, and I'm saying this from conventional medicine perspective, they're just focusing on things that kill bacteria. Instead of looking at the idea that a bacteria has to latch on to the body to infect the host, We're just saying, okay, it's already in you. Now we can come up with novel ways to stop the process of the bacteria from replicating or changing the DNA or making the toxin or different things like that. But if you could stop the, I think cranberry juice is probably a good example that we should maybe share, because I know that's kind of one of the mechanisms of action of cranberry juice, except that's not using a lectin, that's using a sugar. It's almost like a reverse lectin in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Taking cranberry juice, and when a Dr. D'Adamo's trick, they always like to do half cranberry juice and half pineapple. The bacteria that might be sitting in the urinary tract causing a urinary tract infection, which can get burning and hesitancy and a whole bunch of other discomfort kind of the genital system. The bacteria actually can't bind to that tissue if you take a lot of cranberry juice and pineapple juice. So it just gets flushed out. So it's kind of this anti-adhesive thing, taking that scotch tape and putting it into the ashtray so nothing can stick to that scotch tape anymore.
Now, how does the blood type have to do with, like, other aspects of our lifestyle, like how much exercise we should get? Maybe you could run through, or our nervous system, or the way that we kind of perceive the world. I know there's been research, even in Japan, it's kind of interesting, and Korea, too. It's funny, my daughter has a friend that's from Korea, South Korea, and she was saying that blood type, they're even getting into personalities in blood type. So that's kind of fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's literally all based on genetics. It all goes back to kind of genetics. So I'll kind of come around a little bit full circle. But most people don't kind of stop and think of why Dr. D'Adamo made the blood type diet or the eat right for your type diet or wrote the book. And it was a way to try to individualize medicine, saying that not every single person should be on the same exact diet. So this literally goes into, if you know a friend or something along those lines that went on a low carbohydrate diet and they lost a bunch of weight and they're feeling good and looking good and all this fun stuff, and you try it, you don't lose any weight, you don't feel good, but it's supposed to be awesome for you. It's just that diet wasn't designed for you. It's not good. It didn't have the proper nutrients that you needed. So going into this concept of individualized medicine is really where the blood type diet comes in hand, because not all fruits and vegetables are created equal. For example, blood type A shouldn't be eating lima beans, so that's how we figure out their blood type A in the first place. Mm. And by knowing your blood type, we actually can have a look into your DNA, because if we know that you're blood type O, for example, we automatically know that you're blood type O, so that means you have this series of genes or these different genes that go along with being a blood type O. And one of the perfect examples of that is something called dopamine beta hydroxylase, or DBH gene. If you're blood type O, you have this gene mutation. And what this gene does in a blood type O, it causes blood type O's to create a lot of adrenaline, a lot of these catecholamines that like to stay around for a very, very long time. And these type of reactions are more of a fight or flight response, kind of a run away from the saber-toothed tiger or run toward the woolly mammoths go hunting. Compared to, you know, blood type A's, which they have different set of mutations, what makes their blood a lot thicker, makes them clot a lot easier, it makes cancers a little bit easier to stay around in their bodies. There's von Willebrand's factor and factor 7 and a whole bunch of other factors that play a role with your genetics and what you should be eating or not eating based on those foods.
Mm. And what about the bees? Chicken is very bad for bees, which they find very, very troublesome sometimes when I give that news to patients. There's something in chicken, I guess a lectin in chicken, that tends to be a problem for them.
Yeah, that's one of those very, very common ones with blood type Bs. A lot of time I find that blood type Bs have chronic ring in their ears. It's been going on for years. Been going on for so long, they don't even realize that they have it until you say something like that. You ask them a question. Do you have ring in the ears? Like, yes, had it for years. They give up chicken, or you ask them to stop eating chicken altogether, which includes, you know, broths and stuff along those lines, and the ring in the ears will just simply go away, which is one of those amazing things. And my sister, before I was in medicine or anything along those lines, told her brother-in-law this very thing. It's like, hey, you're blood type B, you should not eat chicken if you want to get rid of the ringing in your ears. And it worked.
Yeah, I remember when I was sitting there in Dr. D'Adamo's office as a student, and we had a Hasidic rabbi, and he talks about this story, but I actually sat with this patient. This is one of his famous stories when he's teaching, but I was actually there with this patient. And the rabbi had had several strokes. And, you know, pretty much he ate pretty healthy. He ate tons of vegetables, Dr. Brody. He exercised. He did a lot of things on the right way. But Dr. D'Adamo was like laying a boom down saying, well, you know what? I think that these strokes have to do with you eating a lot of chicken, because he did eat quite a bit of chicken. And I could see it like this was like 40 years ago when this happened. I was in school and, well, maybe 30, but, and then all of a sudden the wife's face was horrified. And the rabbi was like, no chicken, you know, he said all these things. So it was amazing. But once he got off the chicken, his blood thinned out perfectly and he became pretty vital. So goes the legend. I might have embellished the story a little bit. It's become legend now, but I'm sure you have tons of stories there. Well, we have to take a quick break and play the Natural Medicine Chest, our syndicated mini-module program on natural health. But when we return, we're going to transition and talk to Dr. Brody about other research that he's doing, because it's not just about blood type, it's also about genotype. And this is a way to further individualize medicine to you and your family. So stay with us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla, or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sar sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sar sarsaparilla, called sarsaparin, greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sar sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sar sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sar sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And another thing I add about sarsaparilla is if you take it in about a 30-gram per day dose, is very effective to treat Lyme disease. That's for sure, but you do need to take quite a bit of it. So we're back with Dr. Robert Brody. Hey, Dr. Brody, before we forget, tell us a little bit about your website and your practice a little bit.
Yes. My main practice is located in Newtown, Connecticut. I generally work with something called the SWAMI diet and genotype diets with all my patients. And then from there, I'll look into genetics and looking into the digestive bacteria, the microbiome or biota, and figure out what exactly is going on. So I do a generalized, kind of personalized approach to medicine, so not everyone's treatment will be exactly the same.
Great.
Insurance-based, it makes it a lot easier for a lot of patients, too.
Good. Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that, but let's move into that. So, you know, the foundation, of course, of a lot of Dr. D'Adamo's research, and you being his more modern-day trained protege, me being the old-timer, is the blood type. But his research has gone way beyond that, and you mentioned SWAMI and genotype and threw out a bunch of words. Why don't you go back to kind of what Dr. D's been working with and how he trained you on SWAMI and also about the different types of genotypes?
Yeah, just going back to what I was saying earlier before the break, is that if we know your blood type, we know that you automatically have certain genetic mutations. We automatically know that if you're blood type O, you have mutations in dopamine beta hydroxylase and MAOA and a whole bunch of other fancy gene terms out there. So by having a simple $5 test or free test from, you know, American Red Cross, or you go to your doctor to get it done, we actually know a lot of information about that. And going back further is what I was saying earlier, that Dr. D'Adamo designed the blood type diet to individualize treatments for people. So it came down to four diets. So back when he wrote the book, I think it was in 1996 or a little bit before then, it was four diets. It was blood type O diet, blood type A diet, blood type AB diet, and blood type B diet. But he realized that there's more than just four people in the entire world. So he kept trying to personalize it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really his work back in 2000, or when he published one of his next books called Change Your Genetic Destiny, where he started looking at genes and try to separate the diet into a little bit more encompassing for everyone. And that's where the genotype came out.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what types of genotypes. So let's start with O. We'll be organized. We'll go from O to A to B to AB. So what types of subgroups of O's are there now?
So as a blood type O, you can be a hunter, you can be a gatherer, or you can be an explorer. Would be the different genotypes. And each one of those words that I just mentioned, the hunter, explorer, or gatherer, is a different way that that person or that kind of the DNA of that person has control of their kind of genetic destiny. So if you're more of a hunter, you know, you're a little bit more of a kind of reactive blood type, kind of fight or flight response, more and more shoot first and ask questions later, compared to more of a gatherer, which is more of a metabolic kind of blood genotype where you hold on to things, you hold on to sugars and calories and cholesterol and stuff along those lines.
The gatherer?
That'd be more the gatherer, yeah.
Yeah, so they're more kind of like the kapha people, if you use an Ayurvedic term. They're like the kapha O's. Yeah, okay. So they hold on to calories and they hold on to things, and they have a proclivity towards, I guess, diabetes and glycemic problems.
That is correct. Gatherers generally have that issue, holding on to high cholesterol and blood pressure-wise. And generally, gatherers, if you're looking at it from the DNA point of view, they usually have mutations and a whole bunch of different things. Some of the common genes are something called LPL and PPAR and ACE, all these ones have to do with cholesterol synthesis. And, you know, when I'm teaching my students, because I teach a class, one of Dr. D'Adamo's classes for him at the University of Bridgeport called Biochemical Individuality, and I always tell my students to think of the gatherer as an example. Use someone famous in your head, remember what this is. And I always say, think of like maybe Oprah Winfrey, or more like Oprah Winfrey, who always had a problem with kind of weight management. She would be on a diet, she'd lose a bunch of weight, and she'd come back and be back and forth, kind of this more yo-yo dieting, kind of full-figured.
Yeah, and she's blood type O, I assume, right?
I think so. I'm pretty sure she is, but I actually don't know.
So, okay, what's the other type of blood type O?
Well, the hunter, you know, a classic example, hunters are usually tall, thin, and intense. I think of basketball players. They're usually pretty tall, and they're all adrenaline because they're running back and forth on the court, throwing balls back and forth. So they're usually a little bit more prone to inflammation, and since they're more prone to inflammation, there's those autoimmune diseases that are a little bit more likely in this kind of genotype.
I see.
So you usually have mutations in interleukin 6, tumor necrosis factor, and different detoxification enzymes like SOD3 and magnesium superoxide dismutase, et cetera.
So how would you, like, say you had a type O that was, say, a gatherer, how would you instruct them differently than, say, a hunter?
Just because I know the predispositions of the gatherer, which is a little more kind of heart and cholesterol issues, compared to the hunter, which is maybe a little bit more autoimmune issue or a little bit more inflammatory base. So we'll be working with the gatherer, really trying to work on controlling the metabolism, trying to get the metabolism running up a little bit more so they can better handle sugars. So definitely kind of personalize that diet and make it a little bit more of a weight conscious diet compared to more of the adrenaline driven, which is a little more higher protein diet.
I see. Cool. So now let's look at the A's, because they're a very interesting group. They're the second biggest group. What subgroups do they have in the genotype diet?
They have warriors, teachers, and they can also be an explorer as well.
Okay. So what are the warriors like?
The warriors.
Yeah,
so generally, warriors, they're usually really thin in adolescence. When they're developing, they're usually pretty fit and robust. But they later on in life, that's when they gain a lot of weight. So usually when I have a warrior or someone who I think is a warrior and I'm asking them questions, like, yeah, I was always thin my whole life. And then I hit 35 or 40 and all this weight came on and I can't get rid of it.
No, that sounds like my problem. And I was skinny. I was skinny as anything in my 20s, and then all of a sudden I hit 40, and hormones change, and, you know, now I have to work twice as hard to watch my diet and exercise and do martial arts and things like that, but it's an ongoing issue, that's for sure, so, which I'm sure a lot of people in their, 50s and whatnot are struggling with, so that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's just a way of looking at it once again. Generally, warriors have problems with multi-drug resistance genes, so they have a lot of hard times dealing with different medications and drugs and stuff along those lines, mm-hmm. but also that kind of back and forth with the weight, it comes on a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about the other types in the A's?
We said the teacher, and we kept mentioning martial arts there. As you know, I'm a martial artist just like yourself.
Yeah,
and I do Aikido, and the founder of Aikido, his name is O-sensei, or Yoshiba Maraba. And he's the classic example that I have in my head for a teacher. But you can also look at someone a little bit more well-known in, you know, pop culture and U.S. politics called Abraham Lincoln. Generally, very tall people, they're very strong, they're very stable, and they're built really for longevity. So one of their big things is they're very tolerant of things. The mosquito farts, they don't get side effects. They don't get any weird detox symptoms, if little chemical sensitivities, generally speaking.
Interesting.
But they are very tolerant, so they kind of have an Achilles heel when it comes to different like viruses or bacteria, stuff like that. So it'll come in their body, this virus or this bacteria, and the body won't necessarily do anything with it until it gets really, really bad, and then it will go about and fighting it off. So they generally have issues more along the lines with methylation problems. So a lot of cancers and heart diseases and stuff along those lines.
Oh, yeah. And then the bees.
Bees are a very interesting group. It's about 5% or so of the population in the U.S., depending where you are. Once again, bees can be gatherers and also explorers, mm-hmm. but they can also be something called the nomad. And nomads are pretty interesting. It's a little bit more of a smaller group. Generally, I like to think of nomads as Winston Churchill. I like history a little bit, so I always put different people to try to classify them. But Winston Churchill, generally, they have a hard time with environmental conditions. Usually changes in altitude and barometric pressures can be very vulnerable to the nomad. Usually have problems with the immune system and kind of the way that the body, the nervous system, deals with the muscles themselves.
Mm.
Kind of the classic example of a genetic mutation in like a nomad would be nitric oxide. Generally, they have hard times keeping nitric oxide in their body. So they usually have problems with their heart. They usually have more like hypertension. They might have problems with erectile dysfunction. They might have problems with just blood circulation in their body.
Ah, interesting. Okay. What's the other type of bees? I'm thinking of my, I have a lot of bees in my family, so I'm taking notes here.
the other bees, one of the ones we haven't talked about yet was just the Explorer. And the Explorer is more of a reactive blood type, and you can be this genotype if your blood type A, B, O, or AB. So any blood type can be an Explorer.
Oh.
And this is generally the people that you know that are very sensitive to things. If you put on, someone's wearing cologne in the office, or someone used the wrong chemicals, wiped down the countertops, or something along those lines, that will be the person who will react in some regard. So a lot of environmental sensitivities. Once again, being kind of the outdoorsy kind of sports guy, I think of like Lance Armstrong for some reason as more of an Explorer. Not that I know, I never met him or anything along those lines, but I know he's very muscular and he's very adventurous, so he's traveling around a lot. And it's just those traveling around, he might be more sensitive to environmental conditions and environmental toxins and stuff like that.
Well, he ended up having, interestingly enough, you mentioned it, he ended up having testicular cancer, which is a I think is really related to toxins. I mean, there's pretty doubt that, no doubt that free radicals do tend to affect the Leydig cells and the Sertoli cells in the testes and other cells. So that's very interesting. That makes quite a bit of sense. Yeah. What about the ABs? They're, of course, we know they're rare, but they also have several genotype things going on.
They can want to then be an Explorer, kind of think of the Explorer as the kind of catch-all. They can also be the warriors and the teachers as well. So it kind of really depends because they have both the A blood type and the B blood type. So a lot of times they can kind of mix together with the blood type A's and the B's.
So tell us about SWAMI. You mentioned that acronym before.
Yes, SWAMI is a dietary program that Dr. D'Adamo made to try to individualize diets a little bit further. And what we do at this point is we look at something called your phenotype. And all your phenotype is, and what that word means, is just the end result of your DNA. So if I look at someone's blueprint, I'm looking at Dr. Z's blueprint of his house right now. And I see in the blueprint of his house that he should have cedar siding on the outside of that house. That's what the blueprint says, cedar siding. But then I go over to Dr. Z's house and I'm like, huh, that's not cedar siding on the outside of the house. That's a vinyl siding. But your blueprint says cedar siding. What happened there? What's the difference? And that will be the determination of environmental causes, what will cause sometimes to have vinyl siding and not cedar siding. So maybe Dr. Z, you didn't have enough money to get the cedar wood, or maybe that the beetles were all infesting the cedar trees and there was no cedar wood out there, so I had to get something else, and he got vinyl siding. So when I'm looking at the genotype, I'm looking at these end results of the DNA to figure out what your genetic mutations say. So different things like the angle of the jaw, the leg length, your seated height, your teeth, will all play a role in your genetics, the end result of your genetics. And one of the cool parts that we can do now, we can do genetic testing at this point, and we can actually confirm all these things and just be doing these simple measurements.
Right. So you normally would look at, you know, people's what they call anthropomorphic dimensions in their fingerprints and the design of their fingerprints. And so you have all these different anthropomorphic measurements that I know you do. And then you also can run one of these, you know, sophisticated genetic assays, which a lot of people run through, you know, 23andMe and these things like that. And then you can kind of pinpoint all this information.
Yeah, it's a way to really personalize the approach to medicine. One of the really cool ones about these measurements is actually looking at your finger length. You know,
finger
it's
length.
One of those common ones. That, yeah, the finger length. It's pretty amazing.
So everyone, all the listeners out there, should turn their hands over and let's like stare at your fingers, you know, with your palms straight. So Dr. Brody, tell us what we're looking at when we're looking at our hand like that.
So we're going to be looking at our pointer finger and our ring finger. And what we're trying to see right now is which one's longer. And generally, people who are more exposed to testosterone while they're inside their mother being developed and made into a baby, their ring finger will be a little bit longer compared to the pointer finger being a little bit longer, which is a little bit more associated with estrogens. So if your pointer finger is a little bit longer, you have a little more of estrogen inside your body. So we can know this is important because we can kind of see the prenatal environment that makes you unique. So if you have a lot more testosterone, you have more maybe issues around, testosterone-driven pathologies and diseases compared to estrogen-driven ones just by looking at your fingers. And, of course, we can back this up with looking at lab work right now, nowadays, but it's a quick, easy test that you can do just in office to see kind of what your program do. If you go up a little bit further and you look at your fingerprints, it's actually pretty cool as well. Different fingerprint patterns have been associated with different diseases, so it's nothing hard, fast rule, but if you have a lot of whorls in your fingers, a certain design, you're more of an increased risk of maybe breast cancer, or if you have a lot of loops, you might be a little bit more of an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. And we're also looking at something called white lines, which if you ever take a fingerprint and put your finger on a piece of paper with some ink on there, you might see a lot of white lines on there. And that has actually been correlated in studies to show that there's some type of inflammation going on in the digestive tract. So pretty much we'll use all this information, your finger length, your fingerprint pattern, if you have white lines, your blood type, your genetics, your measurements, to figure out a diet that's actually personalized to you and that someone else is not going to have the same diet as you.
Wow. And then from there, people will, a lot of diseases will go away, I guess, because, you know, we go back to our naturopathic roots, you know, sort of remove obstacles to cure and feed the body what it needs to feed, and then the intelligence of the body, the vis, will take care of the rest, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's what it's all about, giving the body the proper things, the proper ingredients, the proper vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, diet, because that way it can do the jobs that it wants to do. That's so great what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, very interesting. So we're running out of time. I'm looking at the time. We have about maybe 6 or 7 minutes left in the program. So is there any cool cases that you want to share maybe of a very fascinating, like people with pretty, you know, you and I have a good interest in rheumatology. I was your rheumatology professor, and it's real nice, and I've invited you into class as a more senior practitioner now to share different rheumatology cases, but anything, and then pertaining to the genotype Swami and blood type thing that you found very interesting in your practice or with research with patients?
As soon as you mentioned
any cases you want to share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two of them popped in my head when it came to rheumatology.
Okay.
One of them is actually more of a gout case. This was an individual who, mid-40s or so, he has something called a non-secretor, which we didn't really talk about much, but it just means that he's not putting his blood type and everything in his body as wet and sticky, so the immune system is not as kind of robust. And he was actually classified as a nomad, if I remember right. And I specifically remember he had arthritis in his big toe, and he was on a medication, I think it was colchicine, to try to get rid of the gout. To get rid of the gout, to stop this, they told him not to eat meat and this and that, the other, all this dietary advice, but nothing was helping this individual. And I did a little bit of research on him because I knew he was from South Asian descent, and I found some research on different genes that are associated with that population. So I kind of took that information, I put that into the Swami diet with all the other lab work that I did, and I cranked out a diet for him that really worked on trying to make sure the body's not making the crystals or anything like that anymore for the gout, and making sure the body's detoxifying that on a regular basis. And I actually have his testimonial up on my website. This is the visual. But, yeah, after 2 months or 3 months on the diet, the gout completely went away, and he had no more issues, which is always nice to hear.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. I mean, nature takes time to heal. I always tell patients it takes years sometimes to get sick. It's going to take a little bit of time for Mother Nature to kick in and heal. But generally when that happens, you get some lasting cures and lasting relief of a lot of these maladies. Any other cases that are interesting?
Just on the topic of rheumatology and like autoimmune diseases, I remember it was probably about 3 years ago or so, I had a patient come in the clinic with mixed connective tissue disease, or undifferentiated mixed connective tissue disease, which pretty much means that the body's attacking itself in the connective tissue, but we have no idea why.
Mm. So it could be a little bit so it's a blend of like symptoms. They get symptoms of like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, other types of things. It's all like a mishmash.
Correct. Yep. Yep. It's this diagnosis that people get, and there's nothing they can do. They take some medications, but they always have it. They never address the kind of underlying issue of why is the body attacking itself? And that's something, you know, that I learned from you in class. You always want to take a step back and learn why the body is attacking itself.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the basic things with this woman that I did was changing her diet. And it just so happened that she was a blood type O, had a little bit more of an overactive immune system. So we went about a process of calming her immune system down. I used a couple different herbs and diet as the main course of treatment with that. And all of her symptoms went away. This was a pretty amazing. Within a month, all of her symptoms went away, well, no medications, et cetera. And then they all came back because she had a cheating weekend. So generally I'm okay with people cheating on their diet every now and then, that kind of stuff. But she went to a barbecue that was all – it was a pork barbecue. So they were having pork, different types of pork from all these world-renowned chefs and that kind of stuff. She ate everything. She indulged. And the next day her symptoms came back. Fivefold increase of horrible pain, rashes coming back, the pain in the muscles and joints coming back. And she stopped it. She went back on the clean diet and all went away again.
Just now, why, to show why you pork? Kind of, I mean, pork, we know, you know, if many religions avoid pork, but there's other reasons for why pork seems to be a culprit.
Yeah, there's actually, I think there's about 13 different lectins in pork. One of the more known studied ones is something called porcelain heart lectin. But pretty much the reason why we dissect pigs in high school and college and stuff along those lines is because that tissue looks very, very similar to our tissue as humans. So when you eat some pork, you can kind of think that your body doesn't know really what to know what to do with it. You're eating this thing that kind of looks like me, but doesn't look like me. So your body's finally going to decide to attack it, and attacks it, and it's fighting it. And in the process of fighting the pork as an enemy, it actually attacks some of the other tissues, your healthy tissues along it. So your immune system becomes kind of overactive or over jealous, and it's just attacking everything.
Wow. Well, thanks very much, Dr. Brody. I mean, this has been a wonderful show, a keeper definitely for folks that were confused about blood type and what it has to do with their health and genotype. You're a great teacher yourself, and really appreciate you taking the time to explain this to people, that it's all not about, like, everyone should give up one food, or everyone should do this, or everyone should be on this diet, everyone should be on the other diet. It's very individualized. What's your website again so folks can get in touch with you?
Website is my last name, ND, so it's Brody, B-R-O-D-Y, N as in Nancy, D as in doctor.com, so BrodyND.com.
Thank you so much. And that'll do it for another edition of Natural Alternatives, the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show. And again, you can get more information on our website. That's drznaturally.com or naturalnurse.com. You have a healthy day. Bye-bye, folks. Take care.